Rogues Gallery Uncovered. Bad Behaviour in Period Costume. A non-judgmental gobble into the scandalous lives of history's greatest libertines, Lotharios, and complete bastards. This podcast contains very, very adult themes, very, very colourful language, and Restoration poetry. If the rhyming description of energetic sexual activities causes you offence, then I can offer only one defence. It may be meagre recompense, but it all took place in the long past tense. You wouldn't believe how long it took me to come up with that. Dildos, defamation, and disguise. Rambling on in search of filth with the Libertine's Libertine. Restoration rake, satirist, alcoholic, and STD enthusiast, John Wilmot, 2nd Earl of Rochester. To be honest, I'm really quite excited about this episode, as it not only features someone who's been requested by several listeners, but who is also the subject of one of my favourite movies, namely The Libertine, starring Johnny Depp. I cannot praise this movie highly enough. Absolutely brilliant script, superb performances all round, and a wonderful score from Michael Nyman. Anyway, before we drink deeply from the flagon of roguery, I thought I'd give what is now, I'm happy to say, becoming a traditional shout-out to another lovable rogue who's got in touch via simon@roguesgalleryonline.com. The address is in the show notes. Tamara GQ, who I believe is based in Los Angeles, thank you so much for your kind words. I'm really, really glad that you enjoy the podcast and that you're also recommending Rogues Gallery Uncovered to all of your friends. It's brilliant. I'm also really grateful for your Latin American rogue suggestion, which is, and I quote, multi-ethnic diplomat, suspected spy, and well-endowed peppermill namesake, Porfirio Rubirosa. That's such a brilliant description. I will add him to the list and have no doubt loads of fun researching more of his scandalous deeds. Don't forget, I'm still on the hunt for more non-European rogues, so keep the suggestions coming, either via direct email or the website roguesgalleryuncovered.com. Link is in the you-know-where. I'd also like to thank the wonderfully named Fighting Irish, who also got in touch to say some nice things via the website. Now, the remainder of this episode is going to be a little different from normal, in that it features two tales instead of one. The first is by way of an introduction to John Wilmot, so you get a sense of his extraordinarily roguish character. The second is a kind of dirty deep dive into one of his most famous poems, A Ramble in St. James's Park. Both are set in the same year. Before we start, though, allow me to be frank at the commencement. The following tale is written in the present tense of the period in which it's set, and as such may contain attitudes and opinions of the protagonists and their times, which would today be considered unacceptable. As I'm not a waywardly self-destructive 17th century literary genius with a raging libido and no respect for anything, honestly, those attitudes and opinions are obviously not mine. I do, however, hope that my reading of a fruity poem at the end does it justice. London, 1673. Bloody hell, John. What have you done? You were supposed to have shown the king a witty poem about dildos. Instead, you presented a verse accusing him of being a whoremongering idler with his brain in his britches. He'll have your bollocks on a spike, no mistake, and you'll never be welcome back at court again. And you say that you did it by accident. Signor Dildo is a really funny poem. Unless you're an Italian nobleman, I suppose. I mean, who wouldn't laugh at the thought of dozens of high-born ladies hopelessly in love with hand-carved Italian pizzle? And all the husbands, furious because now that they've got tireless wooden tools, their wives no longer need them in the bedroom. I nearly pissed myself when I read it. How does it go? You would take him at first for no person of note, because he appears in a plain leather coat. But when you his virtuous abilities know, you'll fall down and worship Senior Dildo. Brilliant. To tell you the truth, though, if every woman at court did take to pleasuring herself with a tass-shaped piece of Italian hardwood, you, Sedley, Etheridge, Killigrew, Villiers, and all the rest of the merry gang, you'd be the first to jump in the Thames. This, though, this is my favourite bit. This senior is sound, safe, ready, and dumb, as ever was candle, carrot, or thumb. Then away with these nasty devices and show how you rate the just merit of Senior Dildo. It's fantastic, and His Majesty would have laughed his wig off. If you hadn't been drunk for the last 5 years, you may have actually given it to him instead of a verse that you only wrote for a select few. You absolute idiot. I do wonder sometimes if you don't enjoy courting calamity. I mean, Charles has been indulgent of you in the past, no doubt, but you're not a beautiful boy of 18 anymore. You're 10 years older. You're pickled with wine, and judging from the sores on your face and the blood in your piss, you're more poxed than a halfpenny French whore. I've lost count of the number of times that you've pushed your luck. Do you remember, back in 65, when you had lovely Elizabeth Mallet kidnapped by footpads, just because you couldn't charm your way under her skirts with your fancy poetry? I'm not sure how romantic she found being waylaid in the middle of the night by the armed men that you hired. Did she swoon with passion as they stopped her coach at the point of a musket and bustled her away to meet with you at a secluded location? You were obviously too inflamed with lust to think particularly clearly, because you only got her as far as Oxford before getting yourself arrested. Not surprisingly, the king was livid. Even he draws the line at kidnapping. So, off to the tower you went. 3 weeks later, though, and you're out. Perhaps he found the deliberately simpering apology you wrote to him somewhat amusing. I would have chosen death 10,000 times rather than displease you. Ugh. I'll say this, mealy-mouthed apology or not, you certainly proved that you'd got some spunk when you sailed away with the fleet after that to fight the Dutch at the Battle of Orford Ness. They say that you were a real hero, rowing between the ships and delivering vitally important messages while cannon fire raged all around you. Thing is, you'd only been back on dry land 5 minutes before you got yourself banished again. I know it was probably a very boring social event, but did you really think it was a good idea to mock Lady Dorothy Howard by convincing everybody that she liked seducing young girls? You whispered these totally false allegations to pretty little Anne Temple, and watched, no doubt with glee, as she burst into tears and ran all the way to her room. I suspect that you knew that, full of innocent concern, Lady Howard would soon follow to offer comfort, and that, possibly prompted by yourself, the matron of the bedchamber would, only a few moments later, burst in, to find her trying to embrace a sobbing half-naked teenager. When the matron told all of what she had seen, everybody thought Howard was forcing Temple to play the game of flats. And by the time the truth came out, she was a complete laughingstock. I believe you got yourself packed off to the continent for that. And while you were gone, Howard made plain to all how she felt about you. "He is nothing but a danger to our sex," she wrote. "And that to such a degree that no woman listens to him three times without irretrievably losing her reputation. He applauds your taste, submits to your feelings, and even though he himself does not believe a single word of what he's saying, he makes you believe it all." I think she's got a point. Who else would have the guts to take the King of England whoring in disguise, like you did recently, and then run away with His Majesty's clothes and his purse while he's busy pleasuring a strumpet? Charles had to ask the board if she'd give him credit, as he was her ruler. As far as she was concerned, though, he was just a lanky, penniless rogue trying to get something for nothing, so she gave him a mouthful of abuse. I would have loved to have seen her face when she realised that the tall, black-haired man was actually telling the truth. Yet still, he forgave you. This time, though, I think you've run out of luck. The king likes fucking. He likes wine. And he thinks dildos are funny. Have you heard, by the way, customsmen have just burnt a huge consignment of them smuggled in from France? But what His Majesty also demands is the respect of his subjects. And accidentally, you gave him this. in the Isle of Britain, long since famous grown for breeding the best cunts in Christendom. There reigns, and oh long may he reign and thrive, the easiest king and best bred man alive. Him no ambition moves to get renown, like the French fool that wanders up and down, starving his people, hazarding his crown. Peace is his aim, his gentleness is such, and love he loves, for he loves fucking much. Nor are his high desires above his strength, his sceptre and his prick are of a length. And she may sway the one who plays with the other, and make him little wiser than his brother. Poor prince, thy prick, like the buffoons at court, will govern thee because it makes thee sport. 'Tis sure the sauciest prick that e'er did swive, the proudest, peremptoriest prick alive. Though safety, law, religion, life lay on't, 'twould break through all to make its way to cunt. Restless he rolls about from whore to whore, a merry monarch, scandalous and poor. To Carwell, the most dear of all his dears, the best relief of his declining years, oft he bewails his fortune and her fate, to love so well and be beloved so late. For though in her he settles well his task, yet his dull, graceless bollocks hang an arse. This you'd believe, had I but time to tell ye, the pains it costs to poor laborious Nelly. While she employs hands, fingers, mouth and thighs, ere she can raise the member she enjoys. All monarchs I hate, and the thrones they sit on, from the Hector of France to the Cully of Britain. That poem was named A Satire on Charles II, and if you're a little bit puzzled by some of the references that Rochester made, I'll clear a couple of them up. Nelly referred to Nell Gwyn, Charles's most famous mistress, she of the Oranges. Hang an arse is, and I'm quoting, a vulgar phrase signifying to be tardy, sluggish, or dilatory. The French fool was Louis XIV, and Carwell referred to Louise de Carwell, the Duchess of Portsmouth, who was another one of Charles II's lovers. The explosive effect of Rochester's mistake was recorded for posterity in a letter dated 20th of January 1674, which said, "My Lord Rochester fled from court some time since for delivering, by mistake, into the king's hands a terrible lampoon of his own making against the king, instead of another the king asked him for." I've yet to determine who sent the letter and to whom, but it's fantastic that this little bit of historical evidence actually survived. Rochester did indeed flee to the countryside, but his exile didn't really last that long, for after an awful lot of obsequious petitioning, he was allowed by Charles II back to court and even made Ranger of Woodstock Park. His behaviour, though, soon got him into even more trouble. But that's another story. However, before he did a runner, Rochester did write a satire that he actually intended everyone to see, based upon his own dissolute routines and observations. It's a somewhat smutty window into 17th century public green spaces entitled A Ramble in St. James's Park. If you wish to take a look at the full text of this poem, you will find a link in the show notes. So, without further ado, let's go back to England, 1673. John Wilmot, the second Earl of Rochester, is in the mood for a spot of poetry. He's taken himself out of London to rest a while in the country. His kidneys are giving him gyp, which could be because he's spent most of the past 5 years in a state of almost permanent drunkenness. One of his favourite drinking companions, groom of the bedchamber to the Duke of York, Henry Savile, whom he often makes fun of for suffering dreadfully with piles, has just had to flee to the continent after a drunken attempt to ravish Lady Northumberland, a highly regarded society widow. Rochester sympathises with his plight as much as he does his anal discomfort, for he too is no stranger to the powerful effects of lust on one's better judgment. Which is why another reason for his aches and pains could be the onset of venereal disease. It's no wonder he's feeling under the weather. As they often do, his thoughts turn to King Charles II. He ruminates on how the merry monarch has the freedom to behave as badly as he pleases, but his royal position keeps the majority of his transgressions hidden from the public. A respectable facade hiding a seedy underbelly. It's a bit like St. James's Park. St James's Park is one of the King's proudest achievements. Bought as marshland by Henry VIII a century and a half earlier, it was made into a park by James I, who filled it with exotic animals and birds from all over the known world. Inspired by the royal gardens he'd explored during his exile in France, Charles had further transformed the space by introducing a wide avenue along which to promenade, a pale male alley, it's a French game a bit like croquet, 36 acres of orchards, and a winding waterway known as the canal. The park had become a favourite haunt of the king, who could often be found there walking his yapping dogs or flirting with wanton orange sellers. By day, this royal association saw respectable London flock to St James to bask in his favour and revel in their own importance. By night, however, it was a meeting place for the lusty and the lewd, who ignored the high walls and locked gates and made free with each other in the shadows. Some enterprising sorts even had their own doors built into the brickwork of the wall, until the king told Sir Christopher Wren to fill them in. If you ask me, he should have stuck to building cathedrals. Rochester has a complex relationship with Charles, and possesses no fear of offending him with the many scurrilous verses he pens at the king's expense. He's a complete opposite of poets like the arse-lickingly obsequious Edmund Waller, whose recent work, fawningly entitled A Poem on St James's Park as Lately Improved by His Majesty, portrays the place as a kind of earthly paradise of which God himself would be envious. Of the king playing a gentle game of pale male, he writes, "His shape so comely and his limbs so strong confirm our hopes we shall obey him long. No sooner has he touched the flying ball, but 'tis already more than half the mall." What a prick! With lines like that, Waller deserves to have his dubious talents mocked as only Rochester can. As he nibbles his quill, Rochester decides to pen his version of Waller's ode as a ramble, an increasingly popular narrative device during which a well-heeled young man goes out in the world in search of low pleasures. Chuckling to himself, he begins to write, "A Ramble in St James's Park." Rochester is getting pissed with some of his disreputable friends at a tavern called the Bear and Harrow near Drury Lane. The conversation turns, as it does when one is in one's cups, to sexual exploits, with each man attempting to outdo his fellows in tales of debauchery. Rochester, however, unlike his boastful friends, is not so drunk that he's incapable of getting his tarse up. He takes his leave and heads off to St James's Park. The fresh air will do him good, and once he gets there, he can pick up a prostitute in one of its leafy alcoves for a restorative shag. As he lurches to his destination, Rochester is lost in contemplation. The park, he muses, might have recently been given King Charles's royal seal of approval, but for centuries it's been a place literally dripping with sex. In fact, there's been so much rampant swiving that's gone on there over the years, even the trees have gone a bit weird. This he puts down to the fact that in ancient times, when blue-painted Picts first wanted to use the park for al fresco carnal exercise, the women these fierce warriors had arranged to meet there rarely made an appearance. Apparently, in ancient times, jilting one's lover was in fashion, although how Rochester knows this is a complete mystery. Convulsed with sexual frustration, generations of Pictish men had no recourse but to pleasure themselves all over the grass. As a result of this somewhat unique form of fertilizer, huge trees had sprung up, the branches of which twined around each other like images from Rochester's favorite pornographic engravings. This collection of smutty imagery was first committed to paper in 1524 by the illustrator Guido Romano, and were widely appreciated by many of the restoration rakes, who each had their own copies. For reference purposes, you understand. It's beneath this lewd foliage that the main pastime of those visiting the park after dark takes place. Although Rochester, being Rochester, he alludes to the most shocking examples of buggeries, rapes and incest. During the day, Rochester ponders, the park plays host to the wealthy and the fashionable, collectively referred to as the town. But at night, all social pretenses are cast aside. High-class courtesans mix freely with backstreet trollops in the earning of a coin or two, while ladies of repute embrace their lovers in shadowy glades, next to low-born servants snatching a few fleeting moments of grubby pleasure. Even ragpickers, who rummage through rubbish looking for scraps of cloth to sell, can walk alongside wealthy heiresses in this world where all are equal with their skirts up. The same is true of the men who frequent the park. noble lords, humble tradesmen, unkempt servants, dandified fops, listless poets and brutal jailers. All are one with their breeches around their ankles. So far, The Ramble has been a satire on the hypocrisy of class and a subtle dig at Charles II, who beneath his robe of royal respectability is just as enthusiastic a coxman as the rest of them, and not above taking the odd mistress or three out and about for a flirt among the hedgerows. But things are about to change. Rochester's Eden of equitable promiscuity is turned upside down when he spots one of his former lovers who's taking a midnight stroll of her own. He refers to her as Corina, the name of an ancient Greek poet. But in reality, it's more likely Rochester was thinking of Elizabeth Foster, a tavern keeper's niece described as a damsel of low degree who had screwed half the rakes in London and given them all the French pox, Rochester included. The Ramble starts to become a vengeful tirade. Corina looks at Rochester like he's a lump of horse shit in a feathered hat, which severely bruises his not inconsiderable ego. To a casual observer, he reckons, it seems she's obviously slumming it from the heaven of being in a relationship with him, a despairing god. But what makes his blood boil is that she's being courted by not one but three young men, each eager to get their end away, and she's encouraging all of them. None of these Knights of the Elbow has very much in their favour. In fact, to Rochester, they're a trio of contemptible losers. The first is a royal courtier, a relative, it transpires, of the woman who looks after the maids of honour at the royal household. This preening popinjay no doubt got his position at court because of his family connections, and he's so lacking in a personality of his own that when he hears from Sir Benjamin Sutton, a gentleman usher of the Privy Council, that the king only eats mutton from Barnstead Downs in Surrey, he swears that he will henceforth eat nothing else. In fact, everything this sad poser does is by rote. Nothing comes from genuine feeling or imagination, all is false, an affectation. The fact that even his lust is fake and his lovemaking is probably just as predictable makes him beneath contempt. The second fellow is a law student at Gray's Inn, a myopic weasel who stands in the front row of playhouses squinting at the leading ladies. Not only does he steal handkerchiefs from other members of the tightly packed audience, but he also steals lines and mannerisms from the plays he watches to pass off as his own when courting women. To make matters worse, it seems as though he's sleeping with his landlady as a way of avoiding paying the rent. More fakery, more deceit. The third doesn't even possess the unsavoury traits of his fellows. He's the eldest son of a rich woman, killing time before he gets his inheritance, who thinks that by associating with these two half-wits, he'll learn how to be a flashing gentleman blade. He's copying the copiers, and as such, leaves absolutely no mark of his own upon the world. Corina, though, laps up their attention, however charmless and unskilled, and with her loins obviously aflame, bundles the three lads into a hackney carriage so she can ride them at home until dawn. This is just the kind of libidinous rake-hell behaviour that gets young gentlemen a slap on the back and a glass of claret. But female rakes, it seems, are not so favoured by Rochester. At least, not this one. If she had the horn because she'd been thinking of him all night and needed a little something to scratch the itch, that would have been fine. She could straddle an erect buffoon or even a well-hung member of the clergy if her lust was genuine and inspired by Rochester, but this rutting for the sake of it is just not acceptable. And it's not as if Rochester hasn't suffered. He had happily coupled with her in the old days when she'd come back to his lodgings after a night of humping all and sundry, even though it was obvious to him that she was just using his seed like a remedy for indigestion after having a big meal. Rochester generously emptied his balls, even though a score of burly porters and footmen had been there before him. What a saint! The main reason for Rochester's ill mood, in the poem at least, is that, unlike most of his previous conquests, he stayed with Corina after he'd taken his pleasure and opened up to her emotionally, revealing his deepest hopes and sensitive fears, stuff that would get him laughed out of town if his riotous mates ever found out. So from here on, he goes in for the kill. He wishes stinking womb vapours upon her and hopes that her unnatural lusts will eventually drive her insane. A more poetic way of saying he hopes she catches syphilis. In a passionate declaration, he says that schoolboys will stop wanking, cowards will stop pleading, retired whores will give up painting as a hobby, priests will stop buggering, heaven will get crabs, and doctors will start believing in Jesus before he will stop hating her. He will wait, he says, until she's married, before unleashing a tidal wave of scandal, truth and lies, which will humiliate her husband and have her ostracised from society, socially and financially ruined. And he will make sure that she knows full well that it was he who was the architect of her destruction. The end. Rochester puts his pen down and takes another draught of wine. All this poetry has put him in fine fettle. He decides the time is right to return to court, after first having his pox looked at by a surgeon and re-establishing cordial relations with his wife. The king, he confidently expects, will be overjoyed to see him. And we now know how that turned out. Don't forget, if you want to read A Ramble in St. James's Park in full, there is a link to it in the show notes. I'll say no more about John Wilmot, as there are at least two more episodes to be written about him. But if you ever get the chance, I do strongly urge you to watch and enjoy The Libertine, starring Johnny Depp. Actually, I will add that The Libertine's Libertine was a savage and skilled satirist who skewered everyone, irrespective of status, station, or social mores. He was fearless, and nothing was off limits to his satirical eye. I think we need more like him. Next time on Rogues Gallery Uncovered. Stop it, or you'll go mad, or feeble, or blind, and then you'll die. A terrifying medical odyssey into the mid-19th century's greatest social catastrophe. The evils of masturbation. If you've enjoyed this podcast and you could follow or subscribe, that would be absolutely brilliant. And if you feel so inclined, give it a high rating or a nice review, that would be even better. Get in touch and let me know what you think, as many of you are doing. You can find Rogues Gallery Uncovered on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or just visit roguesgalleryuncovered.com. There's loads more roguish content there, including pictures, and you can sign up to my newsletter and become a lovable rogue. This has been a bit of a long one. Thanks for persevering with me. Hope you enjoyed it. That's all for now. Have a fantastic fortnight. Stay roguish, and I'll see you yesterday.